Okay, Lee, are you all ready or not yet?
We're ready here.
Okay, I think we have got Madrid and Morelia. Usually, several other European groups join, but I think they're all in Poland still.
Okay.
So I think we should start, and they might join us as we, you know, if they're around, they might join us.
Okay.
They weren't around last week either. Okay.
Okay. Very good. So shall we begin?
Yes, please.
Okay. So so this is an update and is partly work in progress on the subject of braids and prions and so forth. What I want to do, if we go to the second slide, is there's a long outline. I apologize that there are many slides, but most of them are figures, and you'll see that we go through them quickly. I want to start with the first two parts are introductory, especially for people who haven't been around in the subject for a long time, because there are some long-standing issues that this work addresses or relates to, and I want to start by mentioning them. Then I'm going to talk about background, which came from quantum information theory through the work of Marco Polo and Cribbs. Then the model that we published with Sundance, Dolson, Thompson, and Fotini on relating to a prion model of elementary particle physics. And then a paper related to that work by Jonathan Hackett, who is a student here, on how the states that we describe in those models propagate. And that is the published work through number five. Then I'm going to talk about two classes of work in progress. First, and it turns out to matter here, the valence of the graphs. We're working in simplified contexts where the graphs have fixed valence. And the original work and the work that I'll be discussing in number six is further with three valence states. And that's work in progress with Sundance, Jonathan, and Lou Kaufman. And then work on the four-valent case with Yidan Wan, Fotini, and myself. And then, if we have time, some open problems. Okay, so one issue that has been around since spin flow models for more than 10 years are the graphs that describe the states in loop quantum gravity. I'm now on page three, embedded in a three-manifold or not. When loop quantum gravity is derived from a canonical quantization of general relativity, they are embedded, but it's convenient for a reason that I'll come to soon that's relevant here for group field theory and some other approaches to spin flow models to have abstract graphs without embedding. And this is a subject which different people have argued about. People have pointed out, for example, that the geometrical observables, area and volume and so forth, don't measure the topology of the embedding. And a question that this work addresses, well, long-standing question is what is the meaning, what observables or degrees of freedom are representing by the embedding, since they do come from the canonical quantization. Another issue is how should the graphs be labeled? Should they be labeled with SU2, as in the canonical quantization, or the Lorentz or Poincaré group as in spin foam models? I'll skip over this and come back to that. Okay. Related to the labeling issue, next one, we're on number five. We're on page five. Related to that, however, is the issue of framing the graphs. There are arguments both from the canonical quantization and spin flow models that the cosmological constant induces a framing of the graph because the algebra of SU2 that the graph labels come from is quantum deformed, and to represent the quantum deformed algebra, and there in the red are the values of the quantum deformation parameter related to the cosmological constant, the graphs have to have a framing, that is, you have to be able to tell whether you've twisted them or not. And some of the results, in fact, all of the results that I'll be describing today have to do with frame graphs. Okay, next page. Now we come to dynamical issues, page six. And we'll see that these dynamical issues and the kinematical issues are very intertwined. And I start with this to give a kind of background for the results. I think that everybody will see why it's relevant to remind everybody, or in the case of younger people, introduce these issues. So there are Hamiltonian constraint dynamics, which are studied by many people, and spin foam models, which are studied by many people. And there's an important difference in the dynamics. In the Hamiltonian constraints, constructed through the regularization procedure of Tiemann, and indeed to every regularization procedure that's ever been discussed, and I'm on the left-hand side of the graph, one has only the expansion move or its inverse coming from the Hermitian conjugate. That is, a node goes to a triangle, roughly speaking. This has been criticized. It means that physical states have many conserved quantities. For example, they can be constructed according to Tiemann's procedure from a root graph, and the root graph becomes a property of the physical state. And it's not clear that these many conserved quantities have a relation to classical general relativity. However, in spin foam models, there are, in addition to these expansion and contraction moves, exchange moves, where, for example, if you see the three valent nodes on the right, two nodes which are connected exchange their connections, or if you see in the bottom, four valent moves, these moves are called dual Pockner moves because they're moves to changes of triangulations, local changes of triangulations of manifolds that leave the topology fixed. Okay. And what the work having to do with the braids, as we'll see, the exchange moves play a crucial role. Okay, next slide. One way these different issues are related is that if one has exchange moves, as in spin foam models, but if one wants the graphs to represent states embedded in a tree diagram, to define exactly how to make these exchange moves, and I show there the four valent moves, one turns out that one needs the framing to define the topology of the move, for example, after you make the 2-3 move, who is connected to who. Okay. There are long-standing issues about observables. What? Next slide, thank you. Slide 8. And these go back a long way. They have to do with constructing diffeomorphism invariant observables. Related to them, how do we construct and describe the low energy limit of the theory? What does locality mean? Is there a notion in background independent or diffeomorphism invariant theory to describe subsystems? How do we describe gravitons and other local interactions? Are they only properties of the semi-classical approximation, or can we somehow discuss excitations? Related to that is a question of really why are there excitations? I mean, in quantum geometry, we have these dynamics for evolving quantum geometries. Many states get superposed with many other states. Why should there be a notion of excitations? And so these are questions which introduced the work of Krebs and Marco Polo, which was the way that we came into this work. And one way to understand it is to ask two questions about photons. First, if we go back to Minkowski space-time, the vacuum, the ground state, is intrinsically a very noisy state. It's full of quantum fluctuations. What protects a photon in Minkowski space-time from decohering with the noisy vacuum? And the answer is there's a symmetry, Poincaré symmetry. It's a global symmetry. And the vacuum and the states of photons are in different irreducible representations of the Poincaré group. Okay, we're on the next slide. I apologize. And so that makes sense, and that's why quantum field theory on Minkowski space makes sense. In quantum general relativity, however, we don't have a global symmetry in general. We only have either asymptotic symmetries or, in the case of compact spacetimes, no global symmetries. We expect that Poincaré symmetry is only some emergent approximate symmetry of a given state or a given set of histories at maybe emergent low energies. So what keeps, we have this notion of space-time foam that we look, when we look at Planck scales, we don't see any symmetries. We see a superposition of wildly different states with no symmetries governing it, perhaps. So what keeps the photon from decohering with the space-time foam? Is there any notion of excitations in a quantum geometry, dynamical quantum geometry? Okay, next slide, 10. So Marco Polo and Krebs offered some answers to this, which came from the language of quantum information theory. And the analogy, and I can only really here speak of the analogy, is that the same issues arise when one is trying to build a quantum computer. One wants to isolate qubits, which remain coherent and propagate coherently inside a quantum computer, which otherwise is noisy, is full of thermal fluctuations, coupled quantum fluctuations, and so forth. And what has been found is that there are instances where there are little subspaces in Hilbert space called noiseless subsystems that decouple from the noise. That even though when one studies the open dynamics, because they are a subsystem, one still gets pure decoupled propagation of pure states to pure states. And these happen because there emerge symmetries when one separates out the system and the subsystem, that one discovers symmetries which the noise are singlets with respect to, and therefore states in other irreducible representations of those symmetries decouple from the noise coming from the coupling to the rest of the system. And that's the concept of noiseless subsystems. So they proposed that the way to understand excitations in background-independent quantum theories of gravity, particularly spin-foam models and loop quantum gravity, would be to look for such noiseless subsystems. Okay, that's page 11. That's their basic proposal. So there are two classes of results, which were in the paper we published with Sundance, Bilson, Thompson, and Fotini. One, that a large class of theories, loop quantum gravity-like theories or spin-foam-like theories, have noiseless subsystems, which can be interpreted as local excitations. And the second result, the first result is very generic. The second result is that we're on slide 12. Thank you. I have people here who have been very helpful. Is that in a certain specific class, which I'll be discussing in a minute, they matched a model of the standard model, which involved braiding and twisting of edges that had just prior been constructed by Sundance, Wilson, Thompson. Okay, so I'm going to briefly review this model. I'm now on the next page, page 13. Since this is work about a year old, I will rather briefly go through this and then get to the new work. So we discuss here frame graphs of a particular kind shown on this figure where the states are constructed by taking nodes which are trivalent and they have legs on them. They can be seen as little disks with legs coming out and the legs are glued together. And where the legs are glued together, one puts labels which come from the irreducible representations of a quantum group. We're not going to mention the quantum group or the irreducible representations because the main results are independent of their choice, but they can always be there if one desires. Next page. We study a dynamics defined by the dual Pockner moves for three-valent frame graphs. One finds these in many branches of physics, for example, statistical physics. There is an exchange move. I'm now on page 14, the upper right-hand corner, and the expansion move.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question. You're looking at trivalent graph here.
We are coming to four-valent graph soon. Don't worry.
Okay.
Okay. But this is what we started with in this work with Fotini and Sundance. And this has advantages and disadvantages, as you see. And the question was to discover, are there invariants under those moves, and what are the simplest states preserved by the moves? Page 15. First, we look at invariants under exchange moves, and that's easy because the topology of the embedded surface and its embedding remain unchanged, so all invariants of the embedding of the surface are constants of the motion under these first class of moves. Next slide, 16. For example, the length of a ribbon, the link is trace the edges, one gets a set of closed curves in the three-dimensional manifold, and any topological invariant of those is an invariant, a constant of motion under those moves. Next slide, 17. But we also want invariants under the expansion moves, And that, from this point of view, involves adding a circle or subtracting a circle which is unlinked and unknotted, and therefore it's simple to define an invariant, remove from the length of the ribbon all the unlinked, unknotted circles, and take an invariant, any invariant of that, and that's the constants of motion. Next slide, 18. Okay. Now, that allows us also to define a subsystem. If the reduced link, which we've just defined, disconnects from the reduced link of the whole graph, that defines a subsystem, and a topological invariant of that disconnected piece gives conserved quantities labeling the subsystem. And we give some examples on this page. Okay, next page, 19. Okay. Very interestingly, chirality is also invariant. The moves, braids are chiral. Left and right-handed braids are often, sometimes, but often not diffeomorphic. And therefore, there is an invariant, which is chirality. The local moves preserve them. These moves, these invariants distinguish, if you look at the projection of a of an embedding of a graph, which makes a diagram in two dimensions, it preserves overcrossing and undercrossing. It preserves twist and preserves chirality. And we emphasize that these invariants are independent of the choice of the algebra and the specific evolution amplitude. So they're therefore very generic. Next slide, 20. Okay. So we studied what are the simplest subsystems with these invariants, and we considered those that look like the upper right-hand corner of slide 20. There are some nodes. They have legs which go through some braids. They may be braided and twisted and are joined again in some nodes and are joined. They could be joined on one side or both sides to the rest of the universe through a graph. We're only studying here those that are joined on one side. We made use of some existing mathematical technology, which is a group which the different braids form representations of, and invariants of them can so be constructed from the invariants of this group called the braid group. In particular, since there's a correspondence between braids and group elements, there's a notion of an inverse braid to a braid, which we identify with charge conjugation. Next slide, 21. We therefore study the simplest of these, which are three edges braided together, as in the right-hand side of the diagram. We show you there some reduced link invariants to show that they're non-trivial. These are also chiral. Next slide, 22. And then we make the correspondence with the previous published Bilson-Thompson model of prions. And basically the idea here is to revive an old idea about the elementary particles, which is that quarks and leptons and vector bosons have substructure. They're made of triplets of three kinds of particles, charge one-third, charge minus one-third, and neutral charge. And with the idea that the triplet is a conserved excitation captured by a braid, we start here with the two-crossing alternating braid. P and C are what they are. Charge is twist in units of one-third. That's full twist in units of one-third. It turns out in the prion models, to make sense of color, one needed to distinguish the position in some abstract sense of the prions in the bound state, and this was the motivation for Sundance, who, by the way, is here, to organize the systematics in terms of braids. Okay, so we constructed this model, and next page, 23, mapped the first generation of fermions into the different ways to twist the edges of these braids. And these all correspond to distinct topological invariants. One has to do a computation to show that these are all distinct states under the dynamics that are discussed here, and they are. So that's the interpretation. Next slide. 24, and this gives exactly the right states of the first generation of the standard model. They're all left-handed. Next slide shows the right-handed ones, so one has chirality. Next slide, that's the review of that paper.
I think we should stop here for a minute and ask for, because you've just finished the summary.
Very good, thank you.
Okay, so let's ask for discussion about everything that you have said so far. The older work, so to say. Any questions, comments?
What about the Gage boson?
We have so far. Sundance, in his paper, had proposals about the Gage boson, but we are not discussing them in this model yet.
In this model, there's no vector interaction. There's no.
I will come. Most of the rest of the talk is about interaction.
I'm at a point. This is Sundance speaking. I'm at a point about the bosons. Just a simple one, because Lee said he's not going to discuss it in great detail. But you can roughly classify braids into structures that permute the ordering of the strands and structures that don't permute the ordering. So they're either trivial or they come back to the same ordering of strands at the top and the bottom of the braid. And roughly speaking, it seems that the bosons are the ones that don't permute the ordering of the strands, and the fermions are the ones that do. But the actual question of how the interactions take place and how to fit them into this model is still work in progress.
But in this case, I mean, do you have any idea why the bosons thus obtained have spin 1 as opposed to spin 0? How do you distinguish Higgs from vector bosons?
I've got a conjecture, but at the moment it's not sufficiently well developed that I'd like to elaborate on it. That's a topic for another talk, maybe.
Okay. So I think I would like to go back very early on, Lee. I mean, when you started talking about decoherence and why is it that photons don't decohere in Minkowski in the vacuum state, so to say. This is really about slide 9, if anybody's interested. I mean, it seems to me that if I just forget about gravity and just looked at electromagnetism and Dirac particles, I mean, electrons or charged particles, you could ask the same question. And I don't think that, I don't understand the answer that they refer to different representations of the Poincaré group, because even though there are different representations, they clearly, photons can be, you know, there's pair creation by photons. One thing can be transformed into other. And there are also vacuum polarization effects, which really we do see. I mean, that the famous lamb shift. So I don't think that Poincaré invariance by itself says that, you know, that there will be no interaction between the vacuum of one field. In my example, it would be the photons and particles of the other field. So similarly here, I don't see that the physics really lies in these symmetries that you, emergent symmetries that you refer to. So I would like to hear some comments on that.
So my understanding of that is that if we refer to the dress states, that's a question about quantum field theory, but to the fully dressed vacuum, after all the virtual interactions are taken into account, and the fully dressed photons, they still remain in different irreducible representations. From the point of view of
I agree with that, but that's not kind of relevant in the sense that there are physical effects such as a lamb shift.
So,
in some sense, lamb shift is analog of this kind of a dispersion. It just is very small.
No, I think the usefulness of this way of thinking about things is that we can understand why, in spite of the fact that there is a lamb shift, or there is, say, a change in magnetic moment of the electron or the muon, the atom or the electrons or the muons nonetheless propagate coherently through the vacuum. And this is an explanation of that, which is, it's implicit in the calculations that we do in quantum field theory. But if one started from a kind of condensed matter point of view, this would be, one has similar questions there. Why are the excitations of the spin chain, why do they remain coherent? And maybe you don't find this illuminating. I found this illuminating when I learned about this literature. And if it's okay, can I go on to the new stuff and then we can come back to this if it's still relevant?
Right. I think this is just for everybody else so that we are all on the same wavelength when, you know, people from outside ask us questions, we understand what the community as a whole thinks. And
that's the point.
Okay. So the other thing was that it would be useful for many of us if you just tell us about the work that you just finished describing with braids and the moves and so on. It's very pretty, but I think I would like to understand to what extent there is an underlying kind of well-developed mathematical structure as there is for loop quantum gravity or spin forms, in the sense that when the braiding is taken into account, in the sense that do we have a Hilbert space? What is this Hilbert space? I mean, you cannot really talk about holonomies and so on with braiding. So there must be something else. Or it's perfectly fine if, in fact, at this stage, the ambiguity is exactly what the Hilbert space is. But one can still talk about, you know, this. I mean, after a while, things may condense and make it all precise. So we'd like just like to understand what the status is.
So my view, there's a bit of an echo here. Is that at a heuristic level, there is a Hilbert space. You can consider all the diffeomorphically inequivalent embeddings of such surfaces constructed by joining trinions, embedded up to diffeomorphisms, labeled by different irreducible representations as basis elements in a formal Hilbert space. There is no analog, to my knowledge, of the Ashtekar-Lewandowski measure by which this could be derived from a measure theory over a space of connections. And I think there very well might be. I think it's a very, very interesting subject for development and for work. But at the moment, that's my understanding.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? There's one question.
Yeah.
Hi.
One question.
Just a short clarification, Lee. This is Madhavan. These braids, etc., they're in a three-dimensional manifold, or are they to be thought in space-time, or
in a three-manifold. Sorry, I should have said that clearly.
Okay, and the standard model is in flat space-time, but that's somehow I shouldn't worry about now.
We certainly do not claim to have derived the standard model, just to have found some excitations in the dynamical quantum geometry model, which can be mapped to the first generation of the fermions in the standard model. Get the interactions yet. And as I said, how to get the interactions is really the theme of the second half of the talk.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lee.
So now we're transparency.
Great, thanks. So I'd like to ask a question through dependence work. So you identified the standard model particles as certain topological defects in the spin network. So I wonder if you see some consistency condition, like say the anomaly cancellation for in the field theory. I mean, do you have a consistency condition that may correspond to the anomaly cancellation?
I think it's a bit early to be discussing issues like that. I mean, I should emphasize at this stage that really it's a classical model, which effectively you could just build with pieces of paper or something. A full connection to sort of the issues involved in field theory is still some distance away.
One more question is that if I just give you certain particle contents, are you always able to construct some corresponding model in the spin network model? Or, I mean, is there, say, anything special for the standard model model particle contents?
Let me get this clear. You're asking if you gave me some arbitrary set of particles with arbitrary values, could you always construct some sort of braid model through this? I don't know. That's a good question. Maybe somebody who knows a bit more about braiding, like maybe Luke Kaufman or someone, could answer that. But certainly, that's a question that's been raised before, and I'd like to know the answer myself.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We move on to slide 26. What? Okay. So this is a paper by Jonathan Hackett, who's a student here. And he, in the same class of models we've been describing, asked the question of whether there are any interactions and answered it negatively. And I'll briefly explain, I won't go through his proof, but I'll explain the main results, the next slide, 27. So the first part of the slide is the same setup, the local moves. He considered braids of the kind that we have been discussing, two crossing braids. And in the bottom, you see he shows by a series of two local moves that such a braid can be taken to what he calls an isolated structure. An isolated structure is one that's connected. The assumption is there's a big, complicated graph which represents, in some sense, the quantum geometry. And an isolated structure is a topologically non-trivial structure joined to that by a single edge, which is called a tether. And the idea is that once things get into this form, they can move. And he shows, I don't give the demonstration here, but the key result, I'm now on page 28, is that if I have two edges of a link diagram that one can follow from A continuously and get to B, so two pieces of an edge, then there is a sequence of local moves which takes an isolated structure tethered at A to be tethered at B. For example, downstairs we have in the middle graph we have three labeled A, B, and C adjacent to each other, and a lemma following from his result is that you can translate A over B and indeed over C by local moves. These states walk right through each other, so there are no interactions in this model. We suspected that that was the case, but he demonstrated it. Next, page 29. Therefore, to get interactions, barring something that we have not understood, one has to add additional local moves. And we have spent considerable time studying the possibilities.
Sorry, question. Here you have in mind some definition of interaction.
So what we have in mind is that by a sequence of local moves, for example, two braids carrying in these noiseless subsectors could come together and merge and go into a third braid. And we'll see that there are examples of that later on, but there are not examples of it in the dynamics given.
So why the fact that the commute prevents that from happening?
Because what we wanted to happen was interactions in which the particle type would change. I mean, it might be that the propagation amplitudes are modified by crossing each other, so there might be a kind of scattering, mm-hmm. but there's no interactions where the type of the topological structure changes. They have the same topological structure, A, B, and C, before and after.
I think, Lee, there is something implicit in your philosophy that not everybody may already know,
okay.
which is really about what these moves are supposed to do. So just look at your model first before changing it, and what is the idea? I mean, is this move associated with time evolution? Is this somehow, I mean, are the states supposed to, are this?
Very good. There one can either take the point of view, and I think that one can either take either one of these points of view, either that these local moves are part of a Hamiltonian constraint or part of a path integral, spin foam path integral, and they construct a projection operator onto a space of physical state so that a physical state is a superposition of a given state and all those you can get to it by local moves with certain coefficients, as in the Tiemann construction. Or one can imagine that a gauge has been fixed and that we're considering evolution under a real Hamiltonian. Let me just say something else which is implicit, which is that in Sundance's original paper on the prion model, there are interactions which mimic all the standard model interactions between vector bosons and fermions, and we wanted to reproduce those interactions by local moves coming from the quantum geometry. And the conclusion is that they're not mimicable from the two local moves, three local moves that we have been using. Okay. So let me go ahead a little bit.
Just 1 second. It's also because there are people a lot of people who do not know the philosophy. But so from that point of view, if you look at your main result of that you said on page 28.
Okay, mm-hmm.
So if I took the Hamiltonian constraint point of view, then these two states are supposed to be the same state, right?
Well, there's a physical state is a superposition of those. So in a physical state, you would have all superpositions of all orderings of A, B, and C with some phase factors given by the amplitudes and the local moves.
So are the physical states, I'm still confused. So under this, I mean, what has been shown then here? I mean, if A, B, C on the left and the right hand side, B, A, C, that's not representing a physical state. What is it representing?
It's representing a component that if the guy on the left side of the arrow with A, B, and C in that order are there, the guy on the right side with B, A, C in that order with the same structures is there, but one never needs to have anybody with different structures.
But the physical...
So, for example, if A represented an electron and B represented a positron, one might hope that there was were local moves that took them into a state that could be identified as a photon.
Okay. But A, B, and C is supposed to represent, this total thing is supposed to represent one component, right? A physical state is supposed to be a superposition of all these three. Is
that absolutely.
Right? So there are going to be phase factors in the physical state multiplying A, multiplying B, and multiplying C. Is that correct? Or?
No, multiplying each possible basis element in which they occur in different orders.
Okay, but this move would not necessarily preserve the phase factors then, right? I mean,
no, certainly not.
So then this move is not preserving a physical state.
No, I think we have a physical state which is a solution to a projection operator. Is a superposition of a large number of different graphs. What these results say is that if we have isolated structures like this, the isolated structures will be rearranged in all possible ways consistent with moving them around one edge in the superpositions that make up the physical state. But one will not need different ones. If one starts with, if A, B, and C are an electron, a positron, and a down quark, one will not need anything else.
Okay, but somehow the claim is that that whatever the phase factors there are in front of individual elements are all preserved, so that the action of these moves is well-defined on physical states. Is that the claim?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
Let me...
Yeah, I have another question, which is maybe a bit technical, but if you look at these moves, they're always going to stay on a given face, right? You're not going to be able to cross from one face to another.
Yes.
So it's kind of ultra-local there, so you can't...
In a certain sense. So I think, can I just say, in the whatever 20 minutes that I have, the most important thing is to show you the four-valent case where things are quite different from these points of view. So let me ask permission to go ahead and do that and then have discussion.
Sounds good.
Okay. I mean, I think the conclusion of this is that the three-valent case is interesting as a warm-up, there are different points of view about this. My point of view, and some of the collaborators may disagree, is that we need to go ahead. Let me just go back to 29, and then I will jump ahead. We considered adding interactions. In Sundance's model, there are interactions which involve, from this point of view, six trinians rearranged. The challenge is that if you add too many interactions, all the states that we've described so far become unstable. They simply fall apart. And if one adds too few, as in the present case, they don't interact at all. Now, what I'd like to do in light of how the time is going is I'm going to skip Sundance. I'll try to come back to the end. So I will skip from 30 on, and I'll tell you where I'm skipping to 35. So I'm now going to 35 to talk about the four-valent case. What I skipped is work in progress with Sundance, Jonathan Hackett, and Lou Kaufman to further understand and the systematics of the three-valent case. But I think in the limited time, I'd like to talk about the four-valent case. This is work in progress with Yidden Wan and Fotini. And I want to mention Yidden, who's here, has done fantastic work on this. This is work that took a long time to get the right point of view about and get started. So we're going to be looking at now four valent nodes, which is the more natural case that occurs in spin foam models in 3 plus 1 dimensions in any case, still framed. The basic observations on page 36 are that evolution is defined via the dual Pachner moves. The dual Pachner moves require frame graphs to, in the embedded case, to tell us who to connect up to who and who is on top and who is on bottom. The initial idea here was Fotini's, that the braids will be stable if we don't allow local moves involving two nodes. So let me, if you go back to that picture on the page before in 35, so you might ask, is there's normally an evolution move that takes two nodes to three nodes. Would you allow us to do that evolution nodes on the two nodes in the center of the picture that are related by the three edges braided up? And the idea, or the initial proposal, was no, only allow the evolution moves in the case that if you took dual tetrahedra and stuck them together according to the braidings, that would be a triangulation of a trivial region or ball in R3. And in a case where that's not true, do not allow the local move to take place. That stabilizes structures such as the one there involving a three-crossing alternating braid.
So, I have a technical question on that, because the triangulation picture is sensitive only to the permutation group of permutation part of the braid, not to the braiding by itself. Right. So when you specify gluing, you just have to specify which
Another way to say that is that there is one way to stick the two tetrahedra together, which gives you a trivial region of R3, and the others by definition don't. That is, there's no instructions as to how to do that. That's another way to say that. The second observation, I'm back to page 36, is that, which was Eden's observation, is that one naturally got interactions between the states captured by the braiding from the remaining Pachner moves that were then allowed. And we're now just going to go ahead and look at some examples, and then I think we'll have time for discussion. So I'm now going to the next page, 37. This is one of these cases where the notation is everything because the calculations can be intricate, and the zeroth order step was to make a good notation. We started with a picture where framed edges are represented by tubes, as in that red tube on page 37, and the nodes are two spheres, and the tubes come into the nodes on circles which are punctured, and that's the standard technology and topological field theory and conformal field theory. One can just draw those as much as one likes, but they're not a very useful notation. A useful notation we found was to represent the tubes by three edges and to represent the nodes, and I'm now in the center left-hand side, following a tetrahedra. So if one had the idea is one sets up the notation by starting with a case where there is a trivial region of a manifold, one triangulates it and one constructs a rule diagram. And then one has rules that tell you how to construct other diagrams that don't correspond to triangulations or other embeddings of these frame graphs that don't correspond to triangulations. The idea is that the three lines that represent an edge correspond to a face where two tetrahedra may be glued. Each of those lines corresponds to an edge of that dual face, and the way that they go through the diagram tells you the orientation, which faces are over and which faces are under. So that's the middle diagram. Now, it turns out when one projects from pictures of things in three space to diagrams, and this is a common theme in knot theory and topology, one starts off with drawings, which in some sense are representing directly embedded in three space, and one wants to represent them by diagrams on pieces of paper that have rules that one can manipulate. So when one defines those diagrams by projections, sometimes it's necessary to have crossings inside the triplet of lines to indicate things that are twisted with respect to the projection or turned with respect to the projection, and we show that in the bottom slide, and that's where much of the subtlety is. Okay, I'm now going to page 38.
A remark on the notation. This is a notation of gold feet here.
Yes, it's related. It's the same notation.
And it was invented, in fact, by Kirby in the 70s to draw topological four manifolds. So Kirby has a huge book where, you know,
right.
That's right there.
Right, thank you. And in four manifolds and four lines.
A visual paper by Roberto de Pietri where, he studied the structure. And so it's...
Yes,
it's a well-known...
I'm not claiming to have invented it, only to have tried to get away with other notation that were not as good.
Yeah, but that was already,
sure.
Or people
sure.
have converged onto that.
Sure. There's no wisdom like old wisdom. Okay. So page 38 shows the dual partner move, some of the technology involved. One starts with, on the left-hand side, with the actual dual move between tetrahedra, two tetrahedra to three tetrahedra. In the left-hand corner is the two nodes in a particular chosen initial state, and then the two to three move is shown to the right of that, and then in just a picture drawn in three space, and then flattened to provide a two-dimensional projection in two ways. And if one looks carefully at that, you'll see that when the projection is made, there are those crossings. And again, I'm not going to have time here in this 10 minutes that I have to keep track of the crossings and the calculations, but that's where the details of the calculations.
But here maybe I make the same remark as before. That is, if you want to assign a triangulation to this drawing, then the braiding doesn't matter. It's only the permutation structure.
No. Let me make it clear. To fix the notation, and because the rules require that there be a dual triangulation.
Yeah.
Okay. In the trivial case, we start with reference to the triangulation, but the states, most of the states have no dual triangulation.
Okay. So usually this notation is there because it represents a manifold or a triangulation, and
yes.
Uniquely. So now you go away from there, and you can put some braids. And okay, you can't assign any, topological manifold.
We agree. The object is not a representation of a topological three manifold. It's a representation of a two surface embedded in a topological three manifold. Okay. The next slide, page 39, I skipped. Page 39 is the 1-4 move and the inverse the 4-1 move, shown in the picture, and then on the right-hand side, a flattening with some twist. Okay. The page 40 is the basic rule that I mentioned of when we allow and don't allow the dual partner moves, and I've already discussed it. And page 41, we go to a simple case, and I don't have time to do all the cases here, but let me discuss. This one illustrates the basic idea. So we're going to first talk about propagation of a braid, which starting with a simple case where there's just one crossing. I'm on page 41, and on the left-hand side, that's called braid A. Braid A has two nodes in it, and to the right, in my point of view, looking at the screen, there is another node, Y, that connects to two things called A and D. And A and D are just names for how that connects into the rest of the network. So node Y is just the next node over to the right from node X. And what we're going to do by a sequence of local moves of the kind discussed is move the braid A from being to the left of the node Y connected to A and D to being to the right of the node Y, which shows that it can propagate across the node. And that involves some moves and some topological changes. So first we make a 2-3 move, which is the red arrows are always, red arrows are always moves, and blue arrows are always just topologically trivial rearrangements. So we make an actual move. We replace the nodes X and Y by three nodes labeled node 1, 2, and 3 tied together by a triangle. And then A and D are connections into the rest of the manifold. Now what we're going to do is slide two of those nodes, 1 and 2, down to the left, and that's shown in the bottom left figure. I won't get into that detail. And then we see in that bottom left figure, we now have the original node that was on the right-hand side and the two nodes, 1 and 2, and they make a topologically trivial region. And one can then, and this has to be checked by looking at the braidings, that it is indeed a topologically trivial region. One does now on page 42 make a 3-2 move, and that's shown on the bottom. On the top, we just remind ourselves how everything has to be wired up in order that the move is allowed. And then on page 43, we show the result of the first 2-3 move. Then we rearrange things. The slide is topologically trivial, but it puts things in a form where we can make on the other side a 3-2 move. And we have moved the braid one step to the right in the network. Okay. Now some remarks. This propagation is chiral. That is, we showed this braid A moving only to the right. If you would try to start it in a trivial configuration and move it to the left, one would not have been able to. Now, how is that possible, one might say, because these moves are reversible. For every move, there's an inverse move. And the reason why is if you look carefully in the figure on the right, two twists have been put in the line between nodes U and V and to the left of node U, and those were not there before. And those are what blocks the trivial application of the moves that would let us move back the other way. That is, with those there, of course, one can reverse it, but normally they wouldn't be there. And that's where the chirality comes from. Okay. Now, we're going to take that same braid and page 45, I just skipped the title there. We're now going to move it to the right until it hits another braid. So now we have the same braid A, and node Y is connected to node Z through a braid, through those three edges being braided up. And the question is, what happens now? Does braid A walk through the arbitrary braid and come to the other side, as happened in the three-valent case, or is there some interaction, or does nothing happen? And just to check that we looked at all the possibilities, for the moment we leave the exact choice of the structure of the node on the right free, although it will turn out that the interaction takes place with the same structure as the propagation. So now I go to page 46. I start again with a 2-3 move. Only this time I want to, and let me go to the next page, 47. I am now to step two in the middle of the page 47 is I want to take that whole triangle consisting of the three nodes, 1, 2, and 3, and slide them across the braid. Keep your eye on that green circle, which the green line, which goes all the way around there, to be able to make the 4-1 move. 4 tetrahedra to 1. There have to be, in fact, 4 curves which represent edges that are going to be eliminated that are trivial and unlinked with each other. And so one has to make sure the routings are there. Page 48, we don't have time to check, but people can check, is the checking that all the structure is there correctly. Page 49 is move, and we see the results in the right-hand side is that that simple braid has now been combined with the arbitrary braid B. So the initial simple braid A now is combined with the arbitrary braid B. We see the final result on page 50, and that is an interaction. That's what we were looking for, is sequences of local moves that would bring two braids to join and to combine into one single one. Again, this is chiral. Now, I have only a few minutes, so what I'd like to do is just discuss quickly by telling you on what slide different results are on and then take questions.
I think it'll be really easy. A lot of people are lost in this room, at least.
Okay.
It was very rapid. So it'll be quick to just tell us in like three sentences about, first, there was an issue about no interaction, and now on this slide 50, you got some interaction. So
yeah.
If you can just say in just words what exactly happened.
Very good. Very good. What happens in the four-valent case that does not happen in the three-valent case is that when two braids in this form, each stuck between two nodes, when a propagation of one or both of them brings them to being adjacent to each other along an edge, so the edge is broken by the two braids, each with the two nodes adjacent, then there is a sequence of local moves that combines them into one single braid. That's what happened.
Okay, so looking at this four-valent is a key in this whole construction. Is that correct?
That's our impression, yes.
Okay.
Okay, now, on page 51, we look at, and following, just look at the picture. That's an alternating braid, two crossing braids. That one propagates to the right, but does not interact. That is, the moves that we just saw make an interaction happen don't happen. So there are some braids that propagate, there are some braids that propagate and interact in the sense described, and there are some braids that propagate but do not interact. Most braids, when they interact and move, are chiral, that is, they can only do it to one side. A few are not chiral, can go to either side. We have not shown you here the systematics of all the different braids we've investigated, but those will be in the paper, which is under preparation, and Yidan is working on a general classification, which will come later, we hope. Okay, so let me jump. There are then some other classes. I just want to jump to 59, just to mention that, and what happens here and in the next slide is just simply to say that if one goes back to a real SINFOM model, we haven't mentioned labels, but one can put all the labels back on, then the different moves come along with evolution amplitudes, and there are also amplitudes given by quantum 6J symbols that come from change of basis within four-valent nodes. And I didn't write out on page 60 all the complicated formula, but one can take your given spin-foam model and actually work out what the amplitudes are in the given spin-foam model. So to say what's in progress and then conclude on 61, there are important questions. Are these fermions? They are chiral, but we still have not shown that they're fermions. A line of thought which is in progress, which is related to the work of Baez and collaborator on non-trivial anionic statistics of graphs, is that edges can be anionic in three dimensions for the same reason that points are anionic in two dimensions, because they give representations of the braid rather than the permutation group. And in physics talk, we're looking for an inverse quantum Hall effect, that is, rather than having a fermion decompose into three anions, we see a prion model as three anions of the Baez kind combining to one fermion. But that is definitely in progress. momentum eigenstates constructed by superposing these translations are in progress. More work on charges, generations, interactions, etc. We're making slow but steady progress on all these questions. So to conclude, page 62, in the dynamics described by the relevant standard dual partner moves, in the three-valent case, the important news is that there are no interactions of braids combining with other braids to make third braids. They're absolutely conserved. One can add new local moves to do that in this case, and that's under study. And then other things that we did not discuss. And in the four-valent case, there is the propagation becomes chiral, which is nice, and there is some interactions. The interactions are generally chiral. Definitely, we're in the early days of studying what can happen in the four-valent case, so far no effort has been made to make a correspondence between the four-valent case and the prion model or the standard model. Our point of view is that we want to understand what's happening in the quantum geometry in the four-valent case, which seems more interesting in terms of providing interactions, but much more intricate. And we're in the early days of sorting out what does happen, what can happen, and we will leave it open once the math is systematized, whether or not there is a correspondence to anything in elementary particle physics. And with that, we thank you very much.
Fantastically, you actually finished in an hour. That's great.
I had to cut some, but thank you.
Right, no. Okay, so we have some time for discussion. Okay, let me just start asking a couple of general questions, because I think in general this idea is, of course, very fascinating, right? I mean, somehow getting some hold on phenomenology of elementary particles, starting from some topological structures in quantum gravity. And in some ways, much more concrete realization of this Wheeler's idea that elementary particle physics is chemistry of geometry. So somehow, but there are several obvious problems that people always have raised, and I just want to understand your current views on it. I mean, I understand that they don't have to be completely solved. One is really this going back and forth between, on the one hand, having really quantum gravity effect. So we're really talking about Planck scales, we're really talking about these excitations. And on the other hand, we are also talking about a time and these particles moving as though they are in some flat space time. So it will be good to understand the kind of how one goes from one picture to the other picture. And the second is really that any such quantum gravity effects, of course, the only mass scale that we would have would be the Planck scale. And how could that explain anything having to do with elementary particles where the mass scales are so much smaller? So these are the kind of two questions that people have worried about for a long time. And it would be wonderful to have your current views on them.
Sure. Let me take the second one first. So the second one, so let me first make a remark which is common to all ideas about unification within some version of quantum gravity, is also in string theory, whatever, supergravity, and that's that every theory of quantum gravity that might have some elementary particle unification in it faces a question of scale, and the only known answer is that you may be rescued by chirality. That is, chirality means that separately, if there are modes which are going to correspond to fermions in elementary particle physics, that the left-handed parts and the right-handed parts are separately conserved so that in some low-energy description they would be described by left-handed vial spinners or right-handed vial spinners, and that the chiral symmetry, the separate conservation of the left and the right-handed parts, would prevent you from getting a mass term at Planck scale, which is the coupling of a left-handed part to a right-handed part. So for us, it's very interesting. It's not yet a proof of anything, but it's very interesting that the excitations here are chiral because they offer that possibility, but that possibility has not been realized. Now, that's the first answer. One can then speculate about, obviously, chiral symmetry is broken, and why should chiral symmetry be broken at a scale so much lighter than the Planck scale? And we have some ideas about that, but they're in the realm of speculation, and so let me not discuss them now. We certainly are aware of the issue. The first question, this is a general question about quantum gravity and dynamical quantum geometry. If one takes the usual point of view, which I usually take, then in a spin foam model, one is constructing a projection operator onto physical states, that is, onto the kernel of the Hamiltonian constraint. And time is something which is supposed to emerge either in a semi-classical limit, in a sort of Tom Banks, et cetera, way, which other people studied as well, or you should carefully study evolving concepts of motion, as in Carlo Rovelli's ideas. In either case, what happens is that states that differ from each other by applications of the local moves are taken all together, are summed up with certain phase factors that come from the dynamics, certain amplitude factors, not necessarily just phase factors, that come from the dynamics of physical states in the order of time and so forth, supposed to be disentangled. And you're certainly free to take all these results in that language. If you do so, then the basic idea is that in the physical, since these noise-free, the basic idea of the noise-free subsectors is that there are sectors, finite-dimensional subspaces of Hilbert space, which remain coherent. They remain and can be identified with each other in each term of these superpositions, and so even after you sum up the superposition of states to make a physical state, you can still find these subspaces. And that's really what the meaning of noise-free is in a Hamiltonian constraint language. So I think from this conventional point of view, that's the answer. I hope it's satisfactory to people. Certainly, as a shorthand towards that, I'm happy to confess that I often have in the back of my mind that an alternative formulation of dynamics in which one gauge fixed, and these are real physical amplitudes for evolution in some gauge fixed time. But I see that more as a kind of informal, at least at a stage of development, because that's never really been worked all the way through completely, that's just an informal way of thinking. And I apologize if I sometimes fall to that language.
Okay, other questions, comments?
I have, following up, I have similar questions concerning difficulties of these old dreams of putting matter and topology together. So one difficulty is the proliferation of structure.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The problem is that topology, if you allow topology change or new topological structure, it's a wild beast. And in your case, it can show up in the sense that the Braid group is an infinite group. So. At some point, you will have to be able to tame that taming topology is a tough, usual problem, let's say, in this business. So how do you think you?
We obviously we have only looked at the simplest of these structures. The three-valent case is somewhat different than the four-valent case. In the four-valent case, the states of the kind that we described are only there for two nodes sharing three edges. In the trivalent case, we discussed three edges braided, but clearly one could have n edges braided, and there are similar results for n edges braided. I think
in the case of three edges braided,
there's an infinite number of braids of structures. I think that a conservative point of view is that. What has happened is that it's been discovered that under common versions of the dynamics, these structures, that is, that many of us have studied, these structures are there. They may be a very bad thing, as you suggest. They may be a good thing because of the speculation of connection to elementary particle physics. And I think that more work needs to be done before I would be comfortable making a strong claim on either side of that. I certainly have very optimistic days where things seem to work just right, and very pessimistic days in which things aren't really working right. Although Sundance might not like to hear me say that, I'm more optimistic about the four-valent case than the three-valent case, I don't want to plead, you know, it's early days, blah 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 blah, but I do think that that we're still in the first stages of running down the basic natural questions that follow from the first steps here, and let's see where we are once those have been run down. There's a lot that we didn't show you about the classification and the systematics of states, which are there, some of which is there in the slides if people want to look at it in the three-valent case. And I think that, and also in the four-valent case, there where we don't have, but Eden is working on a classification of what can happen with regard to propagation and interaction. And I think it will be easier to discuss this a little bit further down the line when we have a kind of catalog of possible states and possible phenomena.
Yes. I have a second question, which is, if I think about a particle coupled to GR, it's not enough to have some conserved quantity, because you also want this object to carry some charge of the Poincaré group, mass and speed, right? So you want them to be charged on the Poincaré. So how is it going to happen in this that is, here you don't talk about the labels, you don't talk about the weight, and this is, you know, kinematical and dynamical issue.
So
you have to show at some point that there is some.
Well, I think there are different points of view about this. One point of view is the very condensed mattery point of view, in which one would like to find a ground state, quote, such that the excitations of it, at least to some approximation, transformed under the Poincaré algebra, or some version or deformation of the Poincaré algebra, in the same sense that there, in certain condensed matter models, there are, at quantum phase transitions, there are excitations that propagate as massless chiral particles. But I think that's kind of a hope of several people, but certainly it's early days and nothing like that has been demonstrated in this context.
Yeah, but even if there is no flat space of gravity, you need to, you know, the coupling to gravity is essentially the charge, right? Where it's spin and mass, that's what determine the coupling to gravity. So somehow something is missing there. That is,
absolutely.
That is, as long as you don't say where is the mass and spin and where is the coupling, they can't be particles because they can't carry
absolutely
the charge.
Absolutely. I agree with that.
Okay.
I agree with that. I think there are different points of view. One point of view, which is, I don't know if it's your point of view, but it's related to some of the work that you've done, is to incorporate in the spin foam model these charges coming from the Poincaré or the Lorentz group. And another point of view is that one wants them to emerge in a condensed matter kind of way. And I think that both suggestions are under study. And I would think that it's interesting to study both of them.
Okay, there's one more question from here. Madhavan?
This might be, like, this is completely naive, maybe it's inappropriate, but if I, because I don't know much about these quantum group representations, etc., but if I was just to say that I looked at these states and I just took the volume, the regular volume operator, which seems to count valence, four-valent intersections,
yeah,
then wouldn't these configurations have, this is again relating to Abhay's question about difference in scales, wouldn't these configurations which you talk about have very, very low volume, like a Planck volume or something, and wouldn't one want them to have like this volume of an electron or that scale? Is this a reasonable question to ask?
It is a reasonable question, and your observation is correct. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, again, I think it's too soon to tell. There was a question about the issue of anomalies and so forth in the old version of the prion model. So what doomed the old version of the prion models is that what was required was to make bound states, and they were thinking in terms of gauge interactions, much like the standard model. And the problem was to make bound states that are both chiral and approximately point-like, that is, take up a very small volume, but at the same time are chiral so that they can be very light on the physical mass scale of the theory. And they failed, and the Tuft anomaly argument is part of why they failed. Here, the binding is done because of the rules of the evolution of quantum geometry. It's too soon to make any strong claims, but we do note that they are chiral and they are point-like for the reason that you suggest, and that's encouraging in this case. At least that's my point of view.
Okay, thanks, Lee.
Okay, I think we'll be cut off from the bridge pretty soon, so if there are some quick questions, we can take one. If not, we should thank. Is there a quick question?
I have a comment.
Yeah.
This is Eden when speaking, yeah, because there seems to be a kind of confusion between the case of a trivalent, why there's, in the trivalent case there was no interaction, but then in the four-valent case there is one. So I think that the trivalent, I might not be able to make this very clear in wired telephone without explicitly pointing to the pictures, but the trivalent case and four-valent case are very distinct from each other. So in the trivalent case, the starting point was to match to actually match standard prion model to find those topological braid invariants. And then on top of that, people want to have interactions by using the well-defined evolutional moves, for example, exchange moves, expansion moves, and contraction moves. But then the thing is, in the trivalent case, each vertex has only three legs connecting to it, three edges. So it is impossible to have simultaneously the interaction and the braid by using the already defined evolutional moves. But if, for example, if in the trivalent case people can allow a braid with only two strands, then we can use analogous methods we used in the four-valent case to have the braids interacting with each other. But then a braid with only two strands is, to me, doesn't look like a braid, because we can always debraid it by just a simple rotation. So but in the four-valent case has the advantage to have both a three-strand braid and an interaction under the already defined dual passion moves. So that's what my understanding is.
Yeah, this was very clarifying. Thank you very much for the comment.
Thanks.
I might also add one final comment that I can't resist putting in, related to Laurent's earlier comment about the infinity of the braid group. if people care to look at slide 34, either now or later on, there's an illustration of a braid which is part of a subgroup of the braid group, which is three pairs of alternating crossings. So there are six crossings in total. And that particular braid is deformable into a trivial braid. So if we are only considering this subgroup of the braid group where we have alternating crossings, that subgroup is very definitely finite. And I suppose on my optimistic days, I like to think that this is hinting that there is actually some way that we can tame the topology in another more general case. So that's, once again, not conclusive for the general case, but it does at least give us maybe something to look at and something to think about further down the track.
Thank you. Okay, any last other comments before we cut off? Okay, if not, let's thank Lee again.
Bye-bye, thank you very much.
Okay. Laura, if you are there, can you call me?
Yeah.
Okay.
Give me a phone call.